You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Thanks for listening. Welcome to part two in our series on nominations and the confirmation process. We are going to go behind the Article 1 Advice and Consent Clause and move into a detailed look at the process. What works, what broke, when it broke, and how it's broken. Now, what would a nominee and his or her lawyer need to know about the process? Because a lot of national security lawyers in private practice find themselves in the role of attorneys for nominees. They also, many times we have learned at the ABA, find themselves helping locate a particular nominee in some instances. But tonight we're delighted to have a guest on who may understand this process better than almost anyone in the world. Arnold Punaro is a retired United States Marine Corps Major General. You need somebody with that sort of bona fides. He's got an amazing bio. It's so long that we would talk all day about it if I read it all. So I'll give you a little flavor. He is currently the CEO of the Punaro Group and IRONAR Technology. But tonight, let me go back and tell you why he is the man to be talked to on this. From 1973 to 1997, Mr. Punaro worked for Senator Sam Nunn, who was, you know, moderate Democrat, got talked across party lines, managed to get along with a lot of folks. He worked for him on national security matters. He served as his director of national security affairs, and then as staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee and staff director for the minority. He was directly involved in the confirmation process for secretaries of defense, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and service chiefs, hundreds of civilian nominations, and tens of thousands of military nominations. Now, he was consistently named by roll call as one of the top 50 staffers on Congress. And apparently he's never going to retire ever. And he's written a book, which is called, you'll like this, If Confirmed, An Insider's View of the National Security Process. Sir, thank you so much for joining us. What a pleasure to have you tonight.
Well, such a privilege to be with you and your listeners.
You have so much knowledge. I would like for you to start with the basics. What are the three phases of the process for nominees?
First, let me just say how important these national security nominations are to our overall functioning of government. Like you said, I started back in the 1970s and have seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. So there are three phases of the confirmation process. First, only the president can send a nomination to the U.S. Senate. I hear all the time in the Pentagon, well, the Secretary of Defense has nominated so-and-so, or the Secretary of the Navy has nominated so-and-so. No one in the government can nominate anyone except for the President of the United States. So the first part of the three-phase process is the nomination. And that nomination does not occur until the president and his team considers the various people for the 1,200 or so Senate-confirmed presidentially appointed positions in our government, and there are over 7,000 political appointments in our government. And again, 1,200 go through the U.S. Senate, of which 65 belong solely to the Department of Defense. And so there's a very elaborate process in the executive branch for reviewing these qualifications. Hopefully they understand the skills that are needed for the jobs they're going to be nominated for. And the president sends that nomination to the United States Senate. Now, in the case of a transition, you've seen the media report, well, the president is nominated so-and-so for agriculture. The president's nominated somebody for Department of Housing and Urban Development. Guess what? The president hasn't nominated anyone because he's not the president. Number two, until he's inaugurated on January 20th, he cannot nominate anyone. And so on January 20th, the president is typically sworn in at noon. Then usually the Senate and the House either have a lunch or they'll let the president go over to the president's room, which is right off the Senate floor. And that is where he signs the nominations that he wants to send into the Senate that very day. And the committees of jurisdiction will have conducted hearings, for example, on the Secretary of Defense, on the Secretary of State, on the Director of National Intelligence. Some of the most important nominations, they'll run those hearings after the new Congress is sworn in on January 2nd, 2025. The president will sign the nomination. It'll go to the Senate clerk, be referred to the Committee of Jurisdiction. In the case of DOD, the Senate Armed Services Committee, The Senate Armed Services Committee has to get a quorum. So that's the second phase, the confirmation process. The confirmation process is when the nomination is in the Senate and the committees of jurisdiction, they have the hearings, they do the vetting, they do their paperwork, and that very elaborate process, that part is generally reported pretty extensively in the media. And then the third phase is the appointment process. So let's say the Senate advises and consents to the nomination. It goes back to the president. And remember, you listen on the Senate floor, and when somebody gets approved by the Senate, they say the president shall be immediately notified of the Senate's action. It goes to the president. Before they can be sworn in and take the oath of office to the Constitution, the president has to sign the appointment papers. Sometimes they get signed right away. If he's on travel, sometimes it's days. Sometimes the nominee is not ready to go into government for a couple of weeks and they'll wait. So the three phases are the nomination phase, which is the executive branch, the confirmation phase, which is the Senate, and the appointment phase, which is the executive branch. Those are the three phases. And at any point in any of those phases, a nomination can, what I say, detonate or blow up.
Okay, that's a wonderful primer. And I really like hearing about that process and sort of the commonsensical answer. Sounds like something in a logics class in college where you'd have to decide whether or not there's actually been a nomination based on various rules. But when we talk about these things publicly, or the press does, a lot is made out of the relationship between any president and the nominee. Often they have a history together. These are obviously super important positions. The president's going to need to rely on these people as competence. They have to be very high level performing individuals who can give the president an honest readout on things happening in the world. But there is something called the plum book. What is, was that? Is it still relevant? And how does that play into any of this?
Well, Alyssa, the plum book is a listing of all the roughly 7,000 political appointments a president can make as the chief executive, of which 1,200, not exactly, a little bit under that, have to go through the advice and consent process of the Senate. The other ones do not. He can just make those appointments right away. The president is not going to know personally 7,000 people. And so that personal relationship is basically probably for what we call the level ones, the cabinets, maybe some of the level twos, the sub-cabinet like a deputy. And the plum book is required by law to be published every 4 years by the government affairs. They have new names for these committees in the House and Senate. So there's a listing so that it's publicly known what all the political positions are, and people that aspire to serve in that executive branch go immediately to the plum book and look up and see, you know, oh my goodness, I'd like to be on the West Point Board of Advisors. That's one of the 7,000. I'd like to be on the Navy Board of Advisors. I'd like to be on the Barry Goldwater Scholarship Foundation. I'd like to be the Secretary of Defense. I'd like to be the Secretary of the Navy. It's always was done in public and printed in hard copy. The law was changed several years ago saying it could be done electronically. I'll be honest with you, I've been so busy kind of working on the ones that are kind of in the process right now. I haven't been able to look, but the plum book should be out now. The new plum book that would apply to the government of 2025 should be out and available to people now. It's not who's going to get confirmed. There are no names of people in there. There's a lot of legal technical explanation about some of the positions. And so that's what the plum book is. And they call it the plum book because every one of these jobs, someone considers to be a real plum if they get it.
Okay. And some of those are interesting. I'd never even heard of them, but that just goes to show you how many nominees there must be. Right. So the president doesn't know 7,000 people, but there are all these, I want to be something people looking at the plum book saying, you know what, I'd be great for this, this, and this. So who does find these nominees and make those nominees' names go forward?
We're talking about the incoming Trump administration, and we're talking about their process for doing this rather than talking about what Jimmy Carter did or Ronald Reagan did or any previous administration. The America First Policy Institute has had a process in support of hoping that President-elect Trump would actually become President-elect Trump and get sworn in on January 20th, as will be the case. So they've been working diligently for a number of years on a number of things to be, and their motto is ready on day one. They want the new Trump government to be ready to operate and ready to run the government on day one. And so they've been working on policy and agency action plans for all the departments and agencies. They've been working on potential people that could basically help in that regard. They've been working on the people that will not go through Senate confirmation that can be actually vetted and appointed by the president so they can go into the agencies on January 20th and be relatively in charge. There are various categories of what they can and can't do so that they get started on day one. The president will sign a lot of executive orders on day one, and a lot of people will show up to basically run the government on day one. And so they've been gathering those names. Now, once it turned over and the results of the November election were known, they've created a transition process, a transition team for the Trump administration, co-chaired by Howard Lutnick, who had the lead for personnel, and Linda McMahon, who has the lead for policy and process. And they've been doing that, and the president himself has been heavily involved and engaged in picking what we call the cabinet, the level ones. And these are people generally that he knows, generally that's well known in his system, and they go through a lot of review and vetting. They have been working on this for some time. Now, the second thing is they've had databases where people can say, I'd like to serve in a Trump government. I'd like to serve in a Trump administration. So there'll be people, we call it PPO, Presidential Personnel Office. So once the president is sworn in, Presidential Personnel, PPO, sort of takes over this day-to-day responsibility of staffing the government. And in each agency and department, they have a person that's called the WHLO, W-H-L-O, the White House Liaison Officer. So there'll be a WHLO in the Pentagon working with the new Secretary of Defense, and they will say, look, we've got the following people for Assistant Secretary of the Army for Financial Management, Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works, which runs the Corps of Engineers and bridges and roads and dredging harbors, for the Undersecretary of the Air Force. And the White House Liaison Officer represents the president in that department. That person doesn't work for the Secretary of Defense. They work for the president through Presidential Personnel. And there's a give and take. We hope that most of the time, the people that are going to run the agency have a pretty good say in who the people are that are going to get picked for their sub-cabinet and subordinates. That's not always the case. At the beginning of the last Trump administration, Secretary Mattis was not given a strong voice early on. He pushed back on it, got it worked out, and got into the right battle rhythm. Presidential personnel, once they get past these initial appointments, and the people that are going to work in presidential personnel, they're down at Mar-a-Lago. They're known. They've even announced some of the names. They're working all this. And then that's what's happening. But once the government is stood up, there's a very firm, longstanding process for the review of people for these 7,000 positions, including the 1,200 that go through the Senate confirmation process.
These are such important positions, and the world is, by many estimates, more dangerous than it was at the height of the Cold War. Right now, we have very serious things going on. I guess it's a multilateral, multi-layered threat that's sort of ongoing. We're challenged in some of our longstanding partnerships right now, people that we've relied on. We're looking at potential seismic changes to NATO. We're really facing a lot of challenges that I don't know we've faced at one time in our past. So some of these nominees are going to need to be vetted, because even the smartest human being with the most acute instincts, there can be unknowns about individuals. And so this vetting process, I know you feel pretty strongly that it needs to run its course. What does it look like now? Why is it important? And how does what happens currently differ from what has happened in the past? And if you want to weave into that what your predictions are about how anything might unfold, that would be fine too.
Well, Alyssa, I would certainly concur with your analysis of the threat. I've been saying for many, many years that the world is more dangerous, more turbulent, and more uncertain than the peak of the Cold War. And I was saying it before it was cool to say that. So I totally agree with you. So these national security nominees, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book for about national security, because you've got the Department of Defense, you've got the Department of State, ambassadors, career ambassadors, you've got the intelligence, CIA, the intelligence agencies in DOE, the Director of National Intelligence, you've got intelligence activities in the Department of Homeland Security. These things all relate to our national security. And when we're in this world as dangerous and uncertain, You need the very, very best people to serve in government. To get the very best people to serve in government, they've got to understand the process and be willing to go through a process that has become unpredictable, cumbersome, and in many cases, very painful for them and their families. And there are a lot of people that are the most qualified that aren't willing to do that. And that's why, and we can talk about this later, I've got some major reforms to the process that might help us do that. I don't want to get into predicting. I would say what I've learned over the many years that I've been doing this and the handling of thousands and thousands of nominations, including 12 secretaries of defense, 12 chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as you mentioned, sometimes the most routine, what looks to be the most routine nomination can become the most controversial. And sometimes the most controversial can become really routine. Trying to predict this early in the process, you are absolutely right. Typically, and in the Bush administration, one of the mistakes they made early on is presidential personnel and all the people involved would go through the very elaborate process of saying, okay, we've necked it down to three people for this particular position, and here's our top candidate. Mr. President, we want you to pick this person. Then Bush would pick them, and they hadn't been vetted, and they'd announce it, and then they found out in the vetting process, holy smokes, we can't put that person in. So we always recommend that all the detailed vetting be done before the president makes a decision. And I actually have a chart I use in some of my talks, and it's in the book, of people that didn't make it in all the administrations because of vetting problems. I mean, you go back to the Clinton administration, and you had Zoe Beard and others that had what now is called Nannygate. They had domestic help where they didn't pay a fair wage or they didn't pay the taxes or whatever, and they got bounced out. And then you have people that have other problems. They haven't paid their taxes on time. Senate Armed Services Committee requires of all the 65 nominees, they have to provide 3 years of their taxes that they review to make sure that's all copacetic. There needs to be extensive vetting. I also believe there needs to be a matchup between what are the qualifications for the position they're being vetted for and the qualifications of the individual. I will say in every administration, there's always somebody that gets picked and you scratch your head and say, holy smokes, what do they know about this position? They turn out to be pretty good in the position. And so I've also learned over the years to not jump off the bridge when I see nominees that maybe don't look on their face to be matched up well, because look, these are the president's nomination. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires that individual to basically do what we do in industry, which is if you want to hire, you know, an engineer that's going to do digital engineering for the 787, they're going to have certain qualifications, and you're not going to hire them if they don't have it. That's not the case with political appointees in the executive branch. So the vetting is extremely important. And we in the Senate Armed Services Committee have always relied on the FBI full investigation, which can take 6 to 8 weeks. You all and your listeners are very familiar with going through the security clearance. I graduated from college in 1968, the peak year of the draft for Vietnam. I decided to volunteer for the United States Marine Corps. I served as an infantry platoon commander in Vietnam. I have had a security clearance since 1969, continually. I've never not had a security clearance, including the highest level security clearance. And guess what? Every 5 years or so, I have to fill out the same darn forms I filled out 60 years ago, and the SF-86 has gotten 10 times worse. So the paperwork burden on nominees has gotten worse over the years. That's another area I'd like to reform. But guess what? You want this vetting to occur for these most senior positions, and you want the FBI or a similar credible investigatory body to look at these people. The Senate Armed Services Committee requires the FBI full field to be brought to the chairman and ranking member, and they review it. And there have been a number of them in years past, particularly when my boss was chairman and Senator Warner was the ranking member, there'd be stuff in the FBI full field that didn't show up in any of the other paperwork. They'd ask questions about it. Sometimes the questions were answered satisfactorily. It wasn't disqualifying. Sometimes they weren't. And they said, look, we're not going to process this nomination. So the vetting is extremely important. And that's why many lawyers in this town, you know, are involved in the vetting process and help nominees. And by the way, if you look at all the forms that you have to fill out in the executive branch, the public financial disclosure, the SF-86, there's criminal penalties if you basically put wrong information in there. So I always recommend if you don't know how to fill out the form, find somebody that'll either help you pro bono or hold on to your wallet, because when you hire any of our attorneys in town that are going to do this, they're not $50 an hour attorneys.
Definitely not. And I take your point. We could circle back to this later, that the qualifications of the individual nominated should align with the position they seek. It shouldn't, qualification shouldn't be is really fun at parties or writes good tweets or any of that. It's really right. Got to be, there's got to be some sort of concurrence there. And sometimes there isn't, and it's not exclusive to Trump. We've seen this over and over again. And then some people, as you mentioned, rise to the occasion, which is always terrific. So let's talk a little bit about recess appointments, though, because everybody's quaking in their boots when they hear recess appointments. This is not fully owned by this administration, this incoming administration. We've seen this over the years. Good idea, bad idea. What are the hazards of doing such a thing? And what are the hazards long term to the United States national security?
I would say we have to go back to the beginning days. Recess appointments were put in because the Congress was not a full-time Congress. They only came into Washington on limited occasions. And so for a president to staff his administration, there were times when the Senate wasn't around to provide advice and consent. So they came up with this concept of recess appointments. But it was really not because you wanted to bypass the advising consent process. It was because the Senate wasn't in town and a president might need it. That's when government was exceedingly small. You know, there were five people in Thomas Jefferson State Department. In the early days of the Pentagon, you know, we only had a small handful of confirmed people. And so the proliferation of these confirmed jobs has grown by leaps and bounds. I would say today, the Congress is there full time. Recess appointments are a bad idea because it bypasses the constitutional intent that we have a separation of powers and that the Senate be allowed to give its advice and consent to presidential nominations. And that's why the Senate goes into what we call these pro forma sessions, because the Supreme Court has ruled if the recess is not longer than 10 days, a president can't make a recess appointment. So when President Obama got frustrated with Republican Senate that wouldn't approve some people to the Federal Labor Relations Board, he used recess appointments. Supreme Court invalidated those, and they come up both administrations and every administration and every Senate run by Democrats and Republicans, Harry Reid, Schumer, Mitch McConnell, they use pro forma sessions because they don't want any president, whether it's a president of their own party, bypassing the Senate. So Arnold Pinheiro, you know, having worked this for years and years, I don't think they need to do recess appointments. And right now, of course, there's some people saying, well, you know, we got to use recess appointments because they're slow rolling our nominations. There are no nominations right now. There is no one nominated to anything. There is no one being slow roll. There is no one being delayed. Now, break, break. Both parties have gotten in the habit of slow rolling each other's nominees. I think it's a terrible thing that's developed. You can have people that are on hold on the Senate executive calendar for 18 months that have nothing to do with their qualifications. But right now, they don't need to recess. And I think the Republican Senate will process these nominations in a fairly expeditious fashion, because I don't believe for the institutional history and the institutional preservation, they're going to want to put the president in a position where he really wants to use recess appointments. Maybe they're talking about this now to make sure the Senate kind of moves out smartly. I think for the level one cabinets nominees, and there's a tradition, whether it's a Democrat or Republican president, where it's a Democrat or Republican Senate, for example, typically we approve the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State on day one. So that the Secretary of Defense is in the chain of command. He's the only other civilian that's in the chain of command from the commander in chief to the warfighting combatant commanders. And the world is dangerous as it is today. Anything can happen 24/7. So we want that Secretary of Defense on the job day one. And so the Senate has traditionally gotten those things done. So how quickly they do the rest of the cabinet remains to be seen. But, you know, I think what we have to do is wait and see. Now, when you get past like the level ones and the level twos being a deputy, maybe a service secretary, something like that. Once you get into the day-to-day rank and file, although these are incredibly in the assistant secretary for East Asia or the assistant secretary for strategy, these are incredibly important. They're now slow rolling. You look at the fact that we've had career ambassadors that have served this nation and served this country with great distinction for 30 years, and they rise to the top of the Foreign Service, one of the most elite of our services in all of government. They get out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and they get on the Senate executive calendar. and they're put in the slow roll stall mode and they don't ever get confirmed. You know, we've had in the Biden administration dozens and dozens and dozens. It's one thing to be slow roll a political appointee, but slow rolling our career ambassadors, slow rolling our military that are totally apolitical. We had one senator that held up over 900 flag and general officer nominations for over 8 months. Very disruptive to the chain of command and to the normal functioning of government. So recess appointments are a bad idea. They should only be used in exceptional circumstances. And again, both houses have to agree to go into a recess. And in the Senate, it would take 60 votes. I don't see the Democrats in the Senate agreeing to a 10-day recess. Now, there are people that say a president can force the Congress into a recess. I think that would be the subject of a lot of legal action. I'm not enough of a legal scholar. I'm sure there are people on this that are. I don't think we'll ever get there. The other thing I think is the new leadership, Republican leadership of the Senate are very much supportive of the Senate's prerogatives. They're not going to want to create a prerogative because guess what? When Harry Reid changed the requirement for federal judges where you no longer had to get 60 votes to beat a filibuster and dropped it down to a simple majority, there are a lot of people that would argue that was a bad development. Once you do it, then the other party, if they get in power, they're going to use it too. So if you basically allow this to happen with a Republican president, the next time there's a Democratic president and a Republican Senate, they're going to bypass them too. So bad idea. I hope it doesn't happen. And I think the Senate will act at least on the level ones in a fairly deliberative fashion. Now, whether all the level ones get through or not, I'm not going to make a prediction. Like I've said many times, you know, till you actually get into the hearing phase, and it's a long time between today and when that happens, and a long time between today and January 20th, when senators will actually have to vote other than talk about it and say they like the person or they think they're well qualified. When a senator has to vote on something, they have to really take a deep breath and make sure they're doing the right thing. And so no one's had to vote on anybody yet.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.